What we consume has become a central, perhaps the central, feature of modern life. Our economies live or die by spending. We increasingly define ourselves by our possessions. And this ever richer lifestyle has had an extraordinary impact on our planet. How have we come to live with so much stuff? And how has this changed the course of history? In Empire of Things, Frank Trentman unfolds the story of our modern material world, from Renaissance Italy and late Ming China to today's global economy. Frank Trentman is professor of history at Birkbeck College at the University of London. Again, the title of the new book is Empire of Things: How We Became a World of Consumers from the 15th Century to the 21st. And we welcome Frank Trentman to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to talk to you.
What got you thinking about why and how we consume stuff?
Well, I'm a historian, but it dawned on me that we are really sitting in homes bursting with stuff. If you check out your garage or your attic and then open wardrobes and cupboards, there are so many things and possessions bursting out that I thought, well, we've reached an interesting stage in the history of human civilization. When did this start? How did we come to accumulate just so much?
And how did we? Is this a, I mean, obviously, you're looking at from the 15th century to the 21st. Have our trends changed dramatically over time? Or have we always been consumers, sort of hit the ground running being consumers?
Yes, no, absolutely. Well, there's been a huge transformation, I would argue. Obviously, if the trend had been much more recent, and some commentators today see it all as a post-45 effect of affluence, I could have saved myself quite a bit of time and readers probably a few hundred pages. But it's, I think, important to realize that we are in just one chapter today in a much longer story, and to appreciate what the main forces are that got us to where we are. Now, obviously, we're much richer today than in the past, and that helps us consume. But in itself, it's not just a question of purchasing power. And I would think there are probably three main forces that left their legacy all the way to the present. The first is empire. A lot of what we consume, the things that we take for granted, like drinking coffee or using sugar and tea and chocolate, are ultimately integrated into Western cultures because there had been empires that transplanted goods and people and made this possible. And then you have a second big force, which is the modern city. Now, lots of people get excited about shopping, but underneath the department store, there is a fundamental transformation of how we live our lives and what we take to be normal conventions of our daily lives, such as running water, gas and electricity, transport networks, and those really reshape and intensify consumptions. And third and finally, it's down to the home. A lot of how we consume takes place in the home, and ultimately we've made homes possessions, you know, with mortgages and so forth, but we like to fill them, and that's not just because we want to show off, but the home and the possessions in the home are a sign of who we think we are and how we interact with others.
It does seem in the book that you want to challenge this view that many of us have that consumption is primarily an Anglo-American phenomenon. And you argue that this is worldwide.
Yes. Well, in different ways and in different degrees. But it's quite wrong to think of consumer culture just as an Anglo-American export, which then leads you to the erroneous conclusion that, well, if we fix the Anglo-American capitalist model, we're fine and we're sustainable. There have been plenty of cultures which have seen surges of consumption going back really to the late Ming China in the 15th century, which saw an increase and growing interest in possessions. Africans, West Africans, showed a growing demand for textiles and fine metals and jewelry before Europe colonized Africa. And in the 20th century, you have alternative paths by, say, Japan and Korea, which start turning to a consumer society by putting the emphasis on saving for future desire and possessions. So there are multiple paths that got us to where we are. And I think we have to be realistic and appreciate that different regimes have turned towards consumption. It's not all just private markets and capitalism.
Do you think, as you say, there's several different paths, and are these paths all separate in the sense of everybody kind of went out and did their own thing, or was there knowledge and understanding of what others were doing that impacted what the person on the other path or the culture on the other path was doing?
Yes, no, absolutely, the latter. It's very important that we see this story as a global story where there is an exchange of ideas and norms and habits that crisscrosses cultures. So take the example of what we call the modern bath and modern kitchen. So, you know, a kitchen that will be familiar to most of your listeners, where you have a row of appliances all neatly aligned with running water, you stand to do your cooking, and then you have a separate bathroom and you use gas or electricity. Now, that was quite unknown in Tokyo or other Japanese cities in the early 20th century. And you had a life reform movement which went out, and the life reform movement was supported by the state, but also by housewife associations and architects and social movements that deliberately went out to stop Japanese housewives to sit and kneel by the coal fire to do the cooking and to literally uplift them into a different stage of civilization. Now, these exchanges, of course, are not simple. So it's not just that a culture just imports lock, stock, and barrel, everything from another culture. In the process, it is then adapted. So if you go into a Japanese home today, the organization of the rooms by the architect might look familiar, but how people then use rooms, how they eat, where they eat, how many things they display, and in what combination, that remains very different.
One of the things that you touch on in the book that I found fascinating is waste, and that we have all this stuff and how we waste it and the effect that has on us and, quite frankly, our production and consumption of more stuff.
Yes. Well, waste is a fascinating topic, and I started to dig quite deep in the waste bin. We have this phrase, you know, a throwaway society. And in many ways, that's true. If you just look at the size of waste bins and how much stuff we throw out, paper, plastic, things like that, it's formidable. It's a formidable amount. Though one has to remember that in American cities, people were throwing out more paper already by the 1930s than they do today. But nonetheless, there is another side to the problem, which is that people aren't just mindless, careless consumers. So it's not just that they go shopping, don't know what they've bought, and then they throw it out before they've used it. If you look at what happens to stuff, in addition to people throwing things out, there's a second problem, which is they don't throw out enough. So garages and attics are full with boxes of fully functioning third or fourth TV sets, which contain a lot of metal, which sits there in the box and isn't released back into the economy. Now, arguably, that's an equally big problem because it means that those people who want to get at rare metals or other components need to mine and harvest previously uncultivated lands and resources rather than the TV components that aren't used and sit in the attic flowing back in the economy. So we have two sides. On the one hand, we're using a lot and we're throwing a lot out. But the second problem is we're not reusing a lot. We're just using it once and then it sits there.
Do you believe, given that you have looked at this issue going back to the 15th century, where do you think we're headed?
Well, some people, of course, are great optimists and believe that we've entered a new chapter characterized by the sharing economy or a shift from things and possessions to virtual experiences. Some of that is happening. But if you look at the numbers and you compare how many things people are purchasing and accumulating now in rich and developed economies, not just the United States, but also Sweden is a good example. People in Stockholm today, I mean, in last year, bought four times as many appliances and clothing as they did 15 years previously. I don't see that we're yet in a phase that people call dematerialization. We have more things, and the data suggests there is no decline in that. And the second thing I think is important to stress is that experiences and services, they're not entirely virtual. If we use computers or other electronic devices, they're connected to servers that need cooling and electricity. If you go to a restaurant, most people drive to their restaurant, which needs a car or some form of transport and road. So services also require things. So I think we are in a serious problematic situation where we have this odd paradox that on the one hand we recognize that consumption is important for people's identity, that people use it to express themselves, and in democratic societies we naturally and rightly believe that they should have a degree of choice over their lifestyles. At the same time, the environmental consequences are increasingly putting pressure on the planet.
So let's talk about that sociological and psychological aspect of why we feel better in buying stuff.
Well, I wouldn't say we necessarily feel better. Psychologists have a point saying that can be a short-lived kick, and
right.
many people aren't particularly happy having lots of stuff. But I think that's just asking one question, and there are better ways of looking at it. For most people, consuming is connected to how they live their lives. It allows them to accomplish certain tasks. So, you know, you want to eat, so you cook a meal. For that, you need energy. You don't just want the energy for itself. It's related to a task. Similarly, to take an airplane, most people take an airplane for a purpose, like going on holiday or going on a trip. So consumption is related to practices or what things do. That's one important thing. The second is a more cultural view where consumption is important for our identity. So we do not just as humans exist in a spiritual pure fashion removed from the material world. Things and objects are extensions of our person. And as we grow up, we attach certain personal meanings to the possessions we have. William James, the late 19th century great American philosopher and psychologist, called it the material self. And I think he had a point when he said that we feel grief and suffering and pain when we lose some of our possessions. It's as if someone is taking a little piece of our personality away. And I think that's probably the core importance of consumer culture to our identities all the way today.
The name of the book is Empire of Things: How We Became a World of Consumers from the 15th Century to the 21st. It's published by Harper. Frank Trentman, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
My pleasure.
Great pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Again, the title of the book is Empire of Things, published by Harper. Frank Trentman is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.